So it's been just a little bit under 5 years since we first had a rather exciting discovery that the expansion of the universe seems to be accelerating. And in the time since then, this has been verified by a number of other experiments, or at least has been consistent with a number of other experiments, such that we now have what we call a concordance model, where we have evidence from the microwave background of a flat universe. We have evidence from various cluster methods of a certain level of mass density, and from supernova mapping, in particular the two groups of the Supernova Cosmology Project and the High Redshift Supernova Search Team, an accelerating universe. And they all meet in a rough area, which tells us that the universe is accelerating, and that about two-thirds of the energy density in the universe seems to be made of something that we have no idea what it is. And we've given the name of dark energy to that because it has a strongly negative pressure, and it seems not to cluster on cluster scales and presumably on less than horizon scales. And so obviously, a number of researchers are trying to figure out what is this dark energy, what is causing the acceleration of the universe. It's something that lies outside a standard model of particle physics, and it's been a surprise to cosmology as well. So it's something that a number of communities are very interested in finding out what they are. So from the past and the present, we move toward what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do in the future? And so I'll also talk about a dedicated experiment, the Supernova Acceleration Probe, SNAP, which is specifically designed to probe the accelerating expansion, looking back into the matter-dominated decelerating epoch, and to try to narrow down the classes of theories that could explain this dark energy. So as I say, things have changed in the last 5 years. We have made progress in that from the two supernova experiments giving evidence for acceleration, there are now other indications of less or greater strength saying that the universe is expanding. And I'll quickly run through these in the next several slides. I'll mention, of course, the Type Ia supernova method, measuring the energy density in the dark energy, talking about the equation of state ratio of the pressure to the density, and looking for indications of a time variation, which will give us some physical clues as to what the underlying physics responsible is. And this is strong because it really is a pretty direct translation from the observations to the theory, from the magnitudes to a distance redshift plot to the expansion history of the universe. But in the last few years, there have been a number of other things that have indicated that indeed of order two-thirds of the universe is made of some strongly negative pressure component. Lloyd Knox and collaborators pointed out that the contours of constant time in the universe are fairly parallel, just by coincidence in our particular universe, to the acoustic peak angle that you see in the microwave background, which is, of course, something that can be measured very well. And the number that they get for the age of the universe is of order 14 billion years, with a fairly small error bar. And this is consistent with the work that, for example, Lawrence has been doing as well. And for any reasonable values, or what we think are reasonable values of the Hubble constant, this implies that there's got to be something with a lot more negative pressure around than ordinary matter. But there are some assumptions that go into this, in particular, flat universe, adiabatic perturbations, and so forth. And we always want to keep track of what we've assumed in order to get these conclusions. From the mapping of the acoustic peaks themselves, the conclusion is that there must be a substantial amount of dark energy, somewhere between a half and three-quarters of dark energy. And I think the most recent summary of this was in a paper of Dick Bond and collaborators, where he goes over the collection of CMB experiments and then folds in various priors of various strengths as well to see how that changes. But in particular, even if you don't add the supernova in, he still comes to that conclusion. But again, there are contributions. You're looking at restrictions. You're looking at a reduced parameter space, ignoring tensors, for example, making certain assumptions about large-scale structure and about the Hubble constant. From the large-scale structure surveys that are undergoing, the two-degree field survey, the Sloan survey, starting to map out the matter power spectrum. And from that as well, one gets indications that there should be a component of the universe well beyond ordinary matter, something with a negative pressure. And also from the looks of large-scale structure simulations, we've seen in the last week a number of movies and talks where you see what things look like in a lambda CDM model versus in a standard pure matter CDM model. And just the looks of the galaxy clustering certainly indicates that there's something there besides matter. And again, there are various caveats to apply to this. So let me just quickly go through each of these. In late 1997, 1998, the two teams announced the results. I'll show the ones just from the Supernova Cosmology Project. But the other team's results are completely consistent with that. And so in the plane of the energy density in a cosmological constant component to that of a matter density, one gets error contours. And at the 99% confidence level, it's different when one rules out a zero contribution of a vacuum energy from these original 42 supernova. And that is telling you you're living in a accelerating universe. And now we're able to fold in these other observations as well. And again, one gets this this consistent picture of an accelerating universe with about two-thirds being in a dark energy. So this is from the paper of Knox, Christensen, and Skordis, where he shows you have this tight correlation between the peak, the acoustic peak location of the angular of the CMB and the age of the universe. And I already quoted the number they get of 14 plus or minus a half billion years. From the famous animations of Max Tegmark, you can see what happens as you to the microwave background power spectrum as you change the energy density in a cosmological constant parameter, and one finds that the fits are better for a non-zero lambda, certainly. And then in the bottom, the matter power spectrum, which the data has been improving very, very rapidly recently with the two-degree field, and the Sloan data will be added to this as well. And of course, MAP will be filling in this region fairly soon as well. And the red curve is for a lambda CDM model, so the so-called concordance model, where those three curves intersect, about two-thirds of the universe being in a cosmological constant, one-third in matter. So these are all lines of evidence. Again, combining the microwave background with the large-scale structure, so there are no supernova data in this at all, one is finding, again, this concordance. And so it's not that the supernova, although they were the original thing that are telling us we live in an accelerating universe, everything is not hinging on the supernova now. So if for some reason you thought that there was some flaw in the supernova method, we're getting this concordance from these other methods as well. And in particular, it looks like we do live in a flat universe with of order 0.3 in the matter. So to sum up, the picture we have is so far we're in agreement. We have no idea why we live here or what is causing it. We've got a very strange picture of what's making up our universe, one that seems very far from a sort of Occam's razor picture. We've got all these different components that are entering in at an appreciable level. And of course, the thing that everyone points out is we have no idea what the vast majority, some 95% of the universe, actually is made of, either the dark matter or the dark energy. To take a bit of a historical perspective, in the 1970s, people were worried about this coincidence. Why is the matter density of order the curvature of the universe? And this was solved through inflation by saying, well, you don't have a curvature, but you do have a flat universe. And similarly, in the 1990s, evidence was gradually brought forward saying it looks like that there's a component of a cosmological constant of order the matter density. And again, that's something that's very hard to understand from a fundamental physics level, why a constant should equal a varying quantity like the matter density at the particular time that we look at it. And a number of people, Rob among them, put forth the idea that if you have a dynamical scalar field, quintessence or something like that, that can help explain things. Given this audience who you know knows these things very well, I'm not going to go into the details of why the cosmological constant is something that appears ugly to a lot of people, including particle physicists, and why dynamical scalar fields change this ugly factor into something that's very beautiful. And of course, a number of people disagree that quintessence or dynamical scalar fields have added beauty to, at least to the extent that we'd like to. But the conclusion that I think a lot of people will agree with is we've got a lot of theories out there. You read AstroPH, you've got 2 to 3 papers on dark energy every week, and we have relatively little data telling us what this dark energy actually is. So what we want to do in this historical progression, in the next decade, ideally we would be able to say we now at least can characterize dark energy fairly well, that it is a dynamical field, that the equation of state is not -1, is not the cosmological constant, so some particular value with some reasonable error bars on it, and in particular some indication of whether or not there was a time variation in that as well, because that's what tells you what class of underlying theory one's dealing with. And in the particular case I took here just happens to be one of those listed in the compilation of Jochen Weller and Andy Albrecht, a supergravity-inspired model. So we'd like to get to that stage where we can say something about dark energy at least. So just to go over the basics again, we generally talk about these things in terms of an equation of state of the dark energy, a ratio of the pressure to the density. And this leads to a particular evolution in the dark energy density as a function of scale factor. You have a fairly simple expression when one is talking about a constant, and so the cosmological constant, which is W-1, does not evolve with time. But I want to emphasize throughout this talk that there really is no particular reason to think that the equation of state should be a constant if it's not the cosmological constant. A recent paper by Dick Bond called it a ludicrous idea that W should be constant. And a lot of people who work on the fundamental physics of this, you know, really don't see any reason why W should be constant either. And we can use this as a clue, as I've emphasized a number of times, to telling us what sort of theory are we talking about. Are we talking about a supergravity-inspired theory? Are we talking about, you know, a very flat potential? What sort of things are going on? So the game we're going to play is, as always, we start with observations. We're going to use our CMB data, we're going to use the supernova data to make observations, to map a distance redshift relationship. We then go over to our cosmological model and we look at the expansion history of the universe. The scale factor A is a function of time t, and we can, for example, interpret that in terms of this equation of state factor W of z. And then we want to go one further step to learn what the underlying fundamental physics is, what the field theory is. So some of the big questions that have been asked, and you've all heard the quotes about this is the bone in our throats, or this is you know, the outstanding problem for particle physics right now, and so forth. Is it a cosmological constant? Is it something else? Is lambda zero? And in particular, the problems with the cosmological constant is, why is it so much smaller than it's predicted, to the extent it can be predicted from particle physics? And if it's a constant, if it's not a dynamical field, why is it happening at this particular time? How do we go about detecting dark energy? So there's the dynamical effects on the expansion history of the universe, basically on the geometry of the space-time, which is something that's very closely tied to the observations. We understand how to make this translation. And so I'm gonna say that it's fairly clean and accurate, and I'll try to convince you of that further as we go along. But that's not the only way there is to do it. There are other effects of the dark energy on cosmology and the astrophysics. In particular, unless it's a cosmological constant, it cannot be a perfectly homogeneous field. That would violate principle of equivalence. There have got to be fluctuations at some level. And Rob pointed this out at the Sackler Symposium very eloquently, I think, in his talk, saying quintessence is not just a time-varying cosmological constant, that one has to take into account of the fluctuations. The problem is the calculations seem to show that this is a fairly small effect, and it's happening at large scales where it's buried in cosmic variance. But a number of people, Manoj, for example, has written a paper talking about looking for this as well. One thing that sounds kind of promising is the effect on the growth rate of large-scale structure. Once the dark energy starts to become dynamically important, that's going to shut down the growth of large-scale structure. And this is a very nonlinear process, and so you can hope for a lot of sensitivity there. Again, the problem is, how do we separate that from the rest of the nonlinear effects in the astrophysics, from the gas effects, the baryon effects, and simply not being sure how to treat the nonlinear physics. So that's promising, but it's not yet at the stage. It's not yet, I would say, at the same level of development as the first way. And then you can throw in some wild cards. Can we detect inhomogeneities in the field in some more direct fashion? Or might it even not be treatable as a classical scalar field, but you have some phase transitions or bubble nucleations going on, such that maybe we could see some effects in that way. But my conclusion from going through this list is, right now at least, the cleanest, the way we know best, is mapping the geometry of space-time, mapping the expansion history of the universe. And so that's what I'll talk about for the remainder of that. Fortunately, there's a good handful of ways that we can do that besides the supernova ways. I've listed a bunch here, and this is a slide sort of summarizing the inaugural Chicago Center for Cosmological Physics conference from last December. For each of the methods, they're pretty much the same in that systematics is the leading problem. It's not just a question of going out and making more observations. It's a question of understanding the physics, the astrophysics that's going into them. So we need to solve all of these systematics problems. Again, I think that something like the growth rate is something that's extremely promising in these deep cluster surveys, but no simulations have been done which take into account a dynamical scalar field in its full generality. A few have been done for a constant W, but not enough where you're varying over the entire phase space. You're varying omega matter, you're varying W, and so forth, in order to really understand what the effects are in the growth of structure. And I've been pushing everyone I talk to say, let's start doing more simulations, and let's look at the effects of a time-varying W. And I think I've convinced Carlos Frank to go ahead and do that. So that's certainly going to be an important step before we can really interpret these large-scale structure surveys that are going on. So again, I'm going to concentrate on the supernova because I'm going to try to convince you that's the furthest developed and the one where we understand the systematics best, partly because of the long history of making those observations, and partly because supernova give us a very wide variety of data. So, we're talking particularly about type 1a supernova. These are not core collapse supernova. These are not the big, giant, massive stars that are collapsing, but rather we think that these live in binary systems, that it's a fully evolved star, a white dwarf, which is accreting mass from a possibly main sequence companion, and it accretes mass up until it hits a thermonuclear runaway right before the Chandrasekhar mass, just due to nuclear physics. That's well understood. And we think you get a reasonably standard explosion, and I'll quantify that a little bit in a moment, simply because the Chandrasekhar mass is a fairly universal value. And so you can see from these cartoons the sorts of information we get from the supernova. We get, for one thing, an image, and so we not only see the supernova, we can get the properties of its host galaxy, and we can measure things like metallicity, we can measure things like amount of dust, whether it's near the core, whether it's on the outskirts. We get a brightness versus time, or a flux versus time, a graph called a light curve, and we get a spectrum. So we get a very rich variety of data that enables us to do a lot of cross checks and look for systematic effects. So Type 1a supernova are not perfect standard candles. It would be wonderful if we could find a perfect standard candle out there. And you can see here that there certainly is variation in the peak magnitude in the blue band we're looking at specifically here. These are fairly local supernova at low redshift. There is a variation, but a number of different ways have been proposed to standardize the supernova. So they're not standard candles, but we think they're standardizable candles. And these involve the fact that the width of the light curve is closely correlated with the peak magnitude. And so one particular way of correcting this is called the stretch factor used by the supernova cosmology group. And when we take these data and we stretch correct them, you see that in fact they do lie on a very tight relationship. And that's accurate to about 7% in distance, in magnitude terms about 0.15 magnitudes. And people are doing further research looking for a secondary parameter to make this relationship even tighter. People are looking at wide varieties of supernova in different environments, making sure that there's no systematic effects due to environment that would upset this relation as well. And so far, this relationship is holding very well. So the game you play then is once you get the peak brightness of the supernova, you put it on a Hubble diagram, which is just the faintness of the supernova versus the redshift that you measure directly for the supernova. And as you all know, you get the Hubble law at low redshift, and then you get a certain curvature, which tells you something about the acceleration or deceleration of the universe, more generally about the cosmological model. And then finally, you can interpret that in terms of the equations of state that enter into the cosmology. So you can put it on a vacuum energy or any other component versus mass density and plot up your confidence contours. And from the two groups' work back in 1998, they said if you restrict yourself to a flat universe, you're talking about of order 0.28 in the matter and then 0.72 in a cosmological constant. And in particular, the thing that got a lot of people's attention is the probability of not having a cosmological constant is less than 1%.
I'm sorry, are you gonna talk a bit about how you know that that's not spurious due to systematic effects?
Yes. So what we'd like to do is take these very exciting contours that told us that the universe was accelerating and really start to quantify things a bit better, to go into the era of precision cosmology. No one's allowed to give a talk without using that phrase, I think. So what we'd like to do is reduce these big contours down to a nice little small contour. That's one of the goals then of the supernova acceleration probe. And in particular, you can then test, are you consistent with other observations showing that you're a flat universe? Does this lie somewhere else? And how does that factor in with the equation of state? To put it another way, in terms of the Hubble diagrams, this is the 42 supernova that the SCP published the discovery of the accelerating universe with. And what we'd like to do is extend this much further out in redshift and take this sort of sparse sample and really fill in that Hubble diagram. And that's going to allow us to make much more precise conclusions for the cosmological model. So now we're talking of order 2 to 3,000 supernova that we want, extending out to redshifts of about 1.7. If I subtract out a fiducial model, then you make this into a flat diagram. And so again, these are the local supernova that have been observed. The blue points are the Supernova Cosmology Project, the 42 supernova. What we want to do is extend that out in redshift and reduce the scatter quite a bit. And each of these points is a binning over 50 supernova.
Could you remeasure the low redshift one?
So there are a number of projects that are underway to add to the low redshift ones. The HiZ supernova team is doing a project, and there's a project at LBL as well called the Nearby Supernova Factory that's underway that will get about 200 supernova out to a redshift of about 0.08. And that's designed not only to pin the zero down, but to look for systematic effects, because you get a very wide variety of environments at low redshifts, the same range of environments that you get as you look back in redshift. I've blown up the previous plot now and put on a bunch of theoretical models from the paper of Weller and Albrecht. And you can see that when you get data down at this level, that's what you need to be able to start to distinguish between different high energy physics models. And that unless you have that accuracy, but that accuracy alone is not enough because you can see some models come in very close together, you also need to go far enough in redshift for those to start to diverge. And yet you can also see, for example, from this dotted and this purple curve, you're going to need supplementary information as well. Supernova alone are not going to do it. You need some information, for example, on the matter density, or equivalently here, the dark energy density. And so we're going to need to get these systems, these observations to work together. So here's the usual sort of project flowdown chart. What do we want to do? We want to measure the energy densities. We want to measure the equations of state and the evolution of the equation of state. How do we then design an experiment to do that? We have certain statistical requirements, enough supernova, out far enough to give you leverage in redshift, and then certainly the systematics are quite a driver as well. And what you come out with that, when you put those requirements in, is a fairly simple mission because it's dedicated specifically to this one thing. It's not a general survey instrument, although it turns out to be an extremely good one, but it's really dedicated to using the type 1a supernova method to map the expansion history of the universe to get a handle on the dark energy. And so the design calls for a 2-meter space telescope in order to look to these high redshifts. Very wide field with a lot instrumented with a lot of CCDs and near-infrared detectors, so you can efficiently study large numbers of supernova. A spectrograph as well, detailed analysis of every single supernova that'll really help get your systematics down. So it operates the baseline idea for SNAP right now. It's R&D phase, and so this isn't locked in yet. But the basic idea is it'll have two different survey modes, actually three different ones. One is the main supernova survey, covering 15 square degrees of the sky, going very deep, looking at the north ecliptic and south ecliptic poles. And then there will also be a wide field weak lensing survey, and then there's actually a third guest survey program where people just say, okay, I want to use the instruments in the following manner. And to give you an indication of the progress that such a space telescope would give, this is the size of the Hubble Deep Field. And so every 4 days, you're getting not much fainter than the Hubble Deep Field over a much, much wider area. And then if you co-add over the 9 different filters that SNAP will have, then you can get down to magnitude 31. I'll talk a little bit about the instruments, although this isn't really an instrument audience. We've got a very big focal plane. It's about the size of a pizza, if you want to put it in normal terms. And it's got two types of detectors on it. It has these new technology LBL CCDs on it, covering 6 optical bands. And then it has infrared detectors, possibly Mercator detectors, in 3 bands in the infrared. And again, to give an idea of scale, this is what the WIFPIC field of view is. So it covers not quite 1 of our CCDs. Well, I've given NGST which, as well. So, ACS is just a little bit bigger than that. Yeah. Okay, so then basically we step across the sky. So we've cut away our spacecraft here. And so you're looking right into the detector plane. And the sky sweeps across each of the filters in turn. And so we observe every object in 9 different filter bands from 3,500 angstroms to 1.7 microns. And no one here probably cares about how we have to, when we're orbiting the Earth, how we have to move around. This takes advantage of these new CCDs developed at Lawrence Berkeley, which are radiation hard, so they're very good for space applications. Extremely high quantum efficiency out into the red. You can see that it's much higher than previous CCDs that were developed. And they are not just vaporware, they do exist. They have been made and they have been used on telescopes. And so here's a picture from the Wind Telescope at Kitt Peak, taken with these LBL CCDs, where you're looking through a nebula, because you've got these very red filters, into a star-forming region. And so you can see with this optical CCD, you're seeing redward of 1 micron. And you can read all about it in the newsletter from last year, which was dedicated to the science with these CCDs. Then there's an integral field unit spectrograph. As I say, getting the detailed spectra of each supernova is going to help nail down the systematics quite a lot as well. And so to sort of summarize how we're going to use the data, we've got images, which includes location relative to the host galaxy. Of course, includes the light curve, and we'll have a spectra. And there are certain particular things that you would look for in the light curve and in the spectra to try to nail down the systematics. And so this ties in with the people doing supernova physics as such, who want to study supernova to learn about actual supernova. And so you can look for metallicity, kinetic energy differences, differences in progenitor composition, and so forth, because we have this wide variety of information, this rich stream of information. And then that allows you to put things together to learn about the cosmology. So the science reach that you have is certainly there's the cosmological parameters that we're interested in getting, the densities or the equations of state, but there's a lot of other cosmology that you get out as well. Type 2 supernova, which we'll find lots of, give you a completely independent Hubble diagram. As I mentioned, we have a weak lensing survey specifically dedicated to weak lensing. We're going to find lots of strong lenses as well, and of course we get a huge amount of astrophysics out. And so we hope to get very good contours in the energy density plane, and of course we want to look at the equation of state plane as well. But again, when you see diagrams like this, these are for constant equations of state, which we don't think are we have no a priori reason to believe are physically relevant, and theoretically there's certainly reasons against them. So we really need to include that uncertainty when we talk about how well experiments are going to do. And so this gives one indication. There are a number of reasons why this cannot be done from the ground. Here's one particular idea. And so comparing SNAP to a survey such as have been proposed from the ground to look at 200 supernova out to redshifts of about 0.8 or so. And so if you first look at only the light contours, those are ones where W has been fixed to be constant. You say, somehow I know that W is constant. And so you see SNAP does fairly well. Okay, gets W naught to about 0.05. And this ground-based survey does reasonably well also. It doesn't do that much worse than SNAP. But as soon as you say, as soon as you admit your ignorance and you say, well, I don't know that W is constant, let's allow the possibility, let's not impose the prior that W is constant, SNAP blows up to this region, which as you see doesn't actually degrade your determination of W today all that much when you project to the axes. But the ground-based survey blows up to this and makes it much more difficult to actually determine what the equation of state is. If you said that these ground-based surveys that don't have all the dedicated instrumentation, that don't look into the infrared because you can't from the ground, if those systematics, let's say, are larger than you would hope for, then you blow up into this red contour. And so, as you can see, systematics is going to be a key driver in the design of experiments. And that's why when you design an experiment, you're not just looking at how many supernova can I gather, but you're saying, how well can I test each and every supernova? Do I have spectra of each and every supernova? And so forth. And then this banana off here is what happens if you don't have a matter prior. You see that also messes, this particular one's for the ground. But you can see that a matter prior looks pretty important. So this is just a toy systematic where we're saying there's a magnitude systematic. I'm not giving a physical reason for why you have that. Maybe it's a problem with the calibration. Maybe it's you don't have a good extinction correction because you don't have enough filters. So I've just put in a toy model for what it is.
Is SNAP's advantage due to its extended redshift range or its larger sample?
It's due to a number of things. So the extended redshift range, because systematics behaves differently than astrophysical systematics behave differently than cosmology. It's the fact that it has 9 filters, so it can do extremely good color corrections, dust extinction corrections. It has spectra, so we can divide the supernova up into subclasses. We can say we're only going to make a Hubble diagram of supernova in ellipticals where there's no dust, with a particular value of metallicity and kinetic energy signature. And then we make another Hubble diagram with another class in the outskirts of spiral, blah, blah, blah. And then we can, by comparing like to like in that way, we can know that within each Hubble diagram, we're looking at cosmology. Between these Hubble diagrams, we're looking at systematics, and then hopefully correct for those as well.
So how do you account for the fact that the age of the universe is different? I mean, you're still always depending on a local sample.
That's right.
So that's a different statement.
Right. So the physics of type 1a supernova, this binary system, you know, white dwarf accreting, it should have no idea what the cosmic clock is saying. It can depend on environment, but the range of environments that you see at low redshift, range of metallicities, the range of galaxy ages.
My question is, this is an empirical.
So it's something that you want to test. So for example, there's a paper just out by Mark Sullivan and Richard Ellis that looks at the sample of supernova at Z of 0.5 relative to local, and breaks it down into just what I was talking about, these like-to-like comparisons, ellipticals, spirals, outskirts, cores, and they find exactly the same cosmology no matter which subclass they look at. Obviously, we've got to continue to test this out past the redshift of 0.5, and that's what I meant by this like-to-like, this dividing into subclasses, where we sort of get many different Hubble diagrams based on environments. But we don't think there's any reason why the cosmic age should really affect the supernova themselves. I haven't heard anyone propose a specific reason for that. But
I mean, it's important to keep in mind, we don't understand, you know, a lot of the steps that make a type 1a supernova.
That's true.
So for me, this is a purely empirical exercise. The question is, you have to be careful about statements.
Right.
Of this is empiricism, so you have to test the hypothesis that they are the same.
That's right. That's right. So one can certainly take this as a purely empirical project. There certainly is a lot of supernova theory as well. People have simulations. Peter Hoflick has fairly detailed simulations of supernova explosions all the way from the thermonuclear runaway through to the light curve. What we're saying in the end is, if two supernova have identical light curves and identical spectra over the regions that we're observing them, we're going to say that the physics is the same. That's the amount of testing that we can do. If it doesn't show up in the spectra, it doesn't show up in the light curve, and yet they're somehow different, then yeah, I mean, you know, there's so much, so far science can go, and yeah, okay. So then this is in the plane of looking at the time variation with redshift of W versus W naught, and you see SNAP can again do fairly well in finding what the time variation is, whereas ground-based experiments, they just don't have the redshift range, they don't have the wavelength coverage to be able to narrow it down to any appreciable area.
What's the main difference between SNAP and ground? What is the main systematic difference?
So I'll still say that there are two differences. One is the leverage from the increased the increased redshift coverage, and the other is from the wavelength coverage, that you've got the infrared in there, and so that really lets you get rid of a lot of systematics. So if you could observe to 1.7 microns from the ground with just as good data, and you could observe deep, then you could take a KELT, you could take a 30-meter telescope and, you know, get supernova out to high redshifts and do very well. But it's really just the atmosphere is in the way. And then, as I'll mention, for the weak lensing, of course, space has lots of advantages for that survey as well. And then if you look at something like a very large survey where you're getting several thousand supernova, again, even there from the ground, when you're trying to find the time variation of W, that's not helping you. If you put the prior on that I know somehow W is constant, ground can get you a lot of interesting information. But as soon as you let W vary, you really are forced to go to space. And as I've said, that's really a critical clue to fundamental physics. And so the question is, well, how do we go about parameterizing it? What's sort of standardly used is you simply take a linear expansion in redshift, which Asanta was one of the first ones, I think, to write down along with Drug and Hutterer. And that has worked fairly well in getting a first indication of how a time variation or a redshift variation affects this expansion history. The problem is our observations have gotten a lot better, and in the future we certainly hope that they'll be much better, and you really start to strain this approximation. You can see if you're doing a sort of Taylor expansion, you know, you usually don't Taylor expand around a value that's greater than one. And in particular, we have all this other data from other experiments. We'd like to bring in CMB constraints as well. Clearly you can't use that at all if you're going to go out to CMB redshifts of over 1,000. And so just in the last couple of months, I was playing around with different ways of solving this problem, of taking that next step. And it turns out that something very simple actually works very well. I was pretty surprised by that because I was trying all sorts of complicated things. And if you simply do an expansion in scale factor instead, you get a lot of very nice properties out. For one thing, it's bounded. As you go to high redshift, this W doesn't blow up. It goes to a constant value. It turns out that you can recreate a potential. You can recreate an underlying field theory much more accurately with this than with the redshift expansion. And as an incredible added bonus, it's actually more sensitive to the data. That using the same data in this parameterization, the contours rotate in such a way that you get the time variation more accurately than before. So let me show you graphically what this looks like. So here are four different models for a scalar field. Yes?
I'm sorry, I don't think I understand this expansion. So you're doing the W as a function of the scale factor, where its value today is what?
Is W naught today. So today A is 1. Normalized A to be 1 today.
Normalized to be 1 today.
Normalize the scale factor. I could write this as A over A naught if you like. Okay. So today it's W naught, and then W sub A gives some measure of the time variation of it. In fact, it's a logarithmic derivative, so it's sort of giving you a characteristic scale. So here are four different particle physics models for what this dark energy could be: a supergravity-inspired model, an inverse power law potential, a double exponential, and the Albrecht-Schwartz model. And you can see that they all have different behaviors with redshift. Here I plotted it in terms of log of A. And the dashed lines for each color are how well this approximation, this parameterization, matches. You can see if they're not too quickly varying, then you do a pretty good job. Whereas if you have a sharp variation, then you don't do very well at all. And so it's not a cure-all, but for certain classes of models, it's a pretty good parameterization. And in particular, I'm going to concentrate on the black curve, which is the supergravity-inspired model, simply because some people, well, pretty much just the authors of it, think that it has some actual physical meaning to do with you know, underlying physics. So you can see it does fairly well at matching it, and in particular it does stay bounded. In the light dotted curve, I give what the old parameterization, the linear in redshift parameterization, would do for that same model. It shoots up off the plot and goes to W of plus infinity as you get to high redshift. So you end up with a very good approximation to the true equation of state. In particular, your error out to 1.7 is only 3%. But because what you're observing are actually distances, and distances are integrals over the equation of state, you do even better in distances. And so if you integrate these different equations back to the last scattering surface, you only make an error of 0.2% in the distance to the last scattering surface. And so this allows us to bring in the microwave background constraints on the same footing, in the same phase space, as the supernova constraints. So we can plot them. Yes.
So far, you and others have a two-parameter theory.
That's right.
You're going to have a lot of data. Is it worthwhile, say, instead of this is like z over 1 plus z. How about z over 1 plus z to a power?
Right. So people have talked about more complicated fits, 4-parameter, 7-parameter fits, and so forth. When you start to do your Monte Carlos over these parameters and your other parameters, then you really very rapidly degrade what you're able to say. So right now we're restricting ourselves to 2 parameters, although by the end of the talk I'll show you a sort of a non-parametric way of doing it. But you're right, we want to keep in the back of our mind making things a little bit more complicated as data gets better.
When you said you were able to integrate back to that accuracy, what do you mean by that? I mean,
so,
the difference between that and some theoretical model is...
So the Sugar model, that they give me a V of phi, I integrate Klein-Gordon...
Okay, so you have to know the model in advance to know the existence of that accuracy.
That's right.
Okay.
No, well, to be able to tell how accurate your parameterization is.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So now that we can put the supernova and the CMB on the same footing, then we can plot it up in this parameter space of W prime versus W naught. And if you take the SNAP simulated data and you put a prior on the matter density, then you get certain constraints in this plane. And if you said the true model was the supergravity model, for example, just as one instance of something that has a time-varying equation of state, you get different constraints. But now, if you bring the CMB data in particular you bring Planck data in, you see that you're able to do much better. And this has a number of very interesting consequences. For one thing is, when I bring in the CMB data, I've thrown away my matter prior. And so suppose we get completely confused as to what the matter prior was. Those people who were at the Sackler Symposium this weekend heard some people say they wanted omega matter to be 0.18, and some people wanted it to be 0.35. And so despite a certain minority of the audience saying we already know it to 0.035, it's possible that we'll remain confused as to what omega matter really is. We don't care in this case. We don't need a matter prior with SNAP plus Planck. With those two, fairly advanced data sets, we'll still be able to narrow things down very well. The second thing is, we're not only able to detect a sign of a time variation, but we can put a pretty good confidence limit on it. If the true model is the supergravity model, then we're 3 sigma away from no time variation. We're at the 99% confidence level if that's the particular model. Obviously, if lambda is the particular model, then we don't detect a time variation, so it's hard to say what your confidence level is. But I should also make sure to give credit to my collaborators here that this is really a pretty new discovery, that the CMB is really able to help, because the CMB alone is not able to see a time variation at all. It's just a snapshot, the distance to a fixed redshift. But it breaks degeneracies because it has a different combination of parameters entering in, and so it's able to reduce these contours down a fair amount. So now let me talk about things from a slightly different point of view. So far we've been concentrating on dark energy and parametrizing dark energy. What's the W? What's the equation of state? What's the time variation? Our data are really telling us something much more general than that. It's telling us the expansion history of the universe. And so here we sit today at look back time 0, scale factor normalized to 1, and we can say, what is the expansion history of the universe? By taking the distance redshift relation, we can very easily translate that into a scale factor time relationship. And you can see how SNAP will be able to reconstruct this particular curve. And the hope is, just like when people studied the early universe and they said, what was the thermal history of the universe, that you learned all sorts of other things. You put all sorts of constraints on particle physics from primordial nucleosynthesis, for example, that by reconstructing the expansion history, we'll also be able to learn an awful lot about the framework of our theory. If you prefer to think of things in density versus redshift space, then you get this sort of reconstruction. And in particular, a matter-dominated universe has this slope for the density redshift run. And you can see that we can look back into the region where you're purely matter-dominated. and that the deviation from this slope has really been a sign that there's this dark energy out there as well. If you're more high energy physics inclined, if you say, well, an accelerating universe is just inflation, let's look at things in the same light that you look at them in early universe inflation, you can talk about things in terms of the conformal horizon scale. And then people who deal with inflation know that if I have a constant co-moving wavelength, that things enter the horizon during a decelerated epoch, they leave the horizon during an accelerating epoch, and so whether the slope is positive or negative tells me, am I decelerating or accelerating? And you can see SNAP will be able to map this negative slope, this accelerating epoch, very well, and will be able to go over into this change of slope, into the decelerating epoch. And so this is a different graphical way of getting that point across. As I mentioned before, you can actually test the framework. You can test the Friedmann equations themselves. Instead of parameterizing things in terms of dark energy, you can say, is the Hubble parameter, Hubble parameter as a function of redshift following the Friedmann equations, or is it following something different? And so here I give two specific toy models, a brain world model, which changes the Friedmann equations. This is the model of Defeye, Dvali, and Gavabadze, where you've got gravity leaking out into the bulk on large scales. And so this is a higher dimension theory, giving a change to the Friedmann equation. And Chepligan gas is this odd proposal to unify dark matter and dark energy, where you've got a negative pressure that's inversely proportional to the energy density. So I'm not advocating either of these theories. I'm just saying the tightness of reconstruction that you'll be able to get with the SNAP data will allow you to test the framework itself.
How do you disentangle that from your behavior W?
So that's true. There's certainly a degeneracy. And in particular, this was for a W of minus 1. If you take a W of minus 0.8, you lie pretty much exactly on the brain world curve. So you're not going to be able to do everything. You'll be able to constrain theories to some level. Because again, we'll be able to see the difference between W of minus 1 and W of minus 0.8. So I think this is, in some sense, one of the most exciting things is not only do we want to know the properties of dark energy, but we really want to know, is dark energy the correct explanation for acceleration? Or are we looking at alternate theories of gravity, higher dimensions, or something, you know, even more surprising? To get a bit more down to earth, as I say, you learn a lot from SNAP besides simply dark energy or the cosmology. Let me emphasize the weak lensing a little bit. You'll be able to measure the matter power spectrum and get cosmological parameters from that. And again, there's a huge difference when one's trying to measure these weak lensing shears between looking at something from space and looking at something from the ground. And SNAP will be coming a wide field of several hundred square degrees on the sky. Here's a laundry list of assorted astrophysical science. So if I haven't mentioned your pet project, then I should emphasize that the fourth year of the program will be a guest survey program where people propose to use the instruments on the spacecraft in their particular way. Archive data, even though we're looking for supernova in these fields, we're of course picking up everything else that's out there, and that's going to be publicly distributed, so deeper than the Hubble field and several thousand times larger. So SNAP has been around as a proposal for a few years. We've been asking the community what they would like SNAP to do for them as well. Last year at SNOMASS, we talked to the particle physicists at length, and we produced this, what we call, resource book on dark energy. And this also exists on the web, and it exists in mini CD form. And I forgot to bring the mini CDs that impressed Rob so much to show you all, but I've got some in my office if you want a copy of them. So SNAP has a lot to offer to particle physicists. And we've also been asking astronomers what they want to see. As I had on my laundry list, you can learn a lot of astronomy out of this. So this is from last January's AAS meeting. You can see we had a lot of SNAP-related talks, most of which actually are from people outside the SNAP collaboration, talking about the different sorts of sciences that SNAP can be used for. And I'll put an advertisement in for the Seattle meeting in January. The AAS has given SNAP a special session, and as well we've filled up one of the regular sessions with science talks as well. Again, not all of which have to do with dark energy, a lot have to do with astronomy. So to finish up, there's, you know, no matter what community you're in, there's science for you from SNAP. Here we're particularly interested in the cosmological parameters, in mapping out the dark energy. We'll get the cosmological parameters from both the supernova survey and the weak lensing survey. There's a lot of astronomy to be done as well, and we can even test the underlying framework of the theory, test the sort of standard model of both gravitation, particle physics, and cosmology in general.
Manish? Point, you mentioned that you can test the Friedman equation, but it's not a true statement because what you're measuring is the left hand side, and I can always concoct the dark energy which gives you whatever.
You're saying you can
test
an arbitrary row of t, right? So let me say we can test your pet theory that's hopefully physically motivated in some way and constrain the parameters of that. But that's certainly true. Yes, you can create a row to match your data specifically.
Okay, so Patrick? Could this be done from the ground?
Okay, so I've shown you the plots of sort of, you know, your best shot from the ground. You don't pick up the time variation at all. So What are the advantages? What do you need, as you say? You want enough supernova, you can get those from the ground. You want to go out to redshift past 1.5, you can't get that from the ground unless you can somehow get the atmosphere out of the way. So people can do OH suppression, they can do AO, but you can't do that over a wide field in order to get enough supernovae. You need the spectroscopy also out to that, so again, you need to get the atmosphere out of the way. And that's really the basic problem, is it's mostly the atmosphere that's the problem. The fact that you want wide field, you want deep. So what we say for SNAP is, we say SNAP is wide, deep, and colorful. Okay, we're covering a large area of the sky, going deep over many filter bands. And it's tough to get that combination from the ground. And in fact, we think it's basically impossible, that you really hit a wall at redshift of about 0.8, and beyond that you start to lose a homogeneous sample. You can still pick up some supernova, but it's not homogeneous, and biases start to come in at that point.
I mean, not even picking amazing sites like South Pole.
I mean, the atmosphere, you know, there's still atmosphere at the South Pole.
People are doing volumetric measurements in the South Pole, so they're not too worried about the atmosphere.
Well, I mean, I assume past the micron, you still have OH. I guess your water is a little bit less.
You do, it's just cleaner. So the question is, you're saying there's no good site on Earth where you could have a massive telescope.
Right, so we've done the SNAP simulation group, which is headed by Alex Kim, has done simulations at a number of different sites, Mauna Kea, Paranal. I don't think he's put in the South Pole, you know, for various proposed and imagined telescopes, LSST, KELT, you know, anything you can think of. And the light, he's generated what are the simulated light curves and simulated spectra you get, and basically they look very ratty. You're not going to be able to get the science out as you go to these higher redshift supernovae. Yeah. Okay, so a little bit on status of SNAP. It's just passed a very intensive Department of Energy review where they said, you've got the thumbs up. They haven't quite handed us the check yet, but you know, that's up to Congress pretty much. SNAP is basically a large mid-X, so it's sort of in the 300 to 400 million range. Which, as I said, for 7,000, you know, times the area of Hubble Deep Field is not bad when it's a lot less than Hubble. And the time scale is late 2008, 2009 for launch.
So So just to come back to this discussion about what you can do from the ground, if you were restricted to redshift 0.8, but you had a tremendous number of supernovae, could you beat down?
It's the systematics limit that you're running into. Okay. So at the Irvine meeting where Johns Henry mentioned pan-STARRS can pick up 250,000 supernova, well, you know, the Air Force doesn't want pan-STARRS to be looking at supernova, but aside from that, you still have the systematics. And so you run into problems, especially from the color corrections, that you just, at the higher redshift end, you don't have the filters to be able to correct for the dust. And that really gets you into trouble.
I would agree that your WA parameterization is better suited for the quintessence models. Uh-huh. But that's because the quintessence models have the feature, or the mod, you build the models the way that you don't have, you have more dark energy at high redshift, uh-huh, as compared to a cosmological constant. And then later on, some mystical thing happens and you come up with the energy density and you get a more negative W.
So the WA is in some sense a slow roll approximation. And you're certainly, if you had an oscillatory equation of state, you know, you wouldn't stand a chance with that. So, you know, we're still thinking about things. How do you treat a fast transition?
The thing is that in some way this parameter is biased. I mean, you are biased in the sense that you assume, I mean, you fit the models well because the models are built that way.
Uh-huh.
Or more or less, the sensible models would have the feature that you, with your parameter, are better, is better. But this is not.
I don't think we're ever going to find a single parameterization, at least not one that's practical, that can cover anything that a particle physicist can think up.
Yeah.
So we need to say, okay, well, this is good to look at this particular class, and these other class will find some other way of constraining. Yeah.
I think you say automatically that you don't, in this case, if you don't know anything, the constraints you get depend upon what you assume, and they're very different depending upon what you assume.
That's right.
And without any theoretical guidance, it's hard to know what you assume.
That's right. But you know, restricting some area parameter space is better than not knowing anything. Yeah.
I mean, so any of your restriction plots will be with caveats. You know, if something is varying this way, then
exactly. Just like the old plots in cosmological constant versus matter density plane, and you got some restriction, there was a caveat. Well, it has to be a cosmological constant. So we're generalizing what we can treat, but we can't. We're not talking about everything, right? Except for these A of T plots, right? There, you take your favorite model, however bizarre it is, plot that A of T, compare it to what snap lines, and then you can say, is it consistent or not? So that's in some sense a non-parametric way.
But in general, you can't do all the plots. You can do individual restriction
based. As I say, particle physicists are too clever. They, you know, come up with too many Baroque things. You can't cover everything.
Well, yeah. Essentially, I mean you're always in that situation. I mean, even the CMB, it's a large number of the assumptions that go into.
That's right.
I mean, your parameterization is like someone in the CMB parameterizing their data in terms of the position of the first peak. And
it's a first step, or second step, or something.
At the end of the day, what you're going to do is what people do in CMB, which is you get your model and you have all your cosmological parameters, and you're going to fit, you know, some supermodel or some exponential potential, and you're going to constrain those parameters.
That's right.
This is useful for forecasting. But in practice, you're not going to use
That's right. It's useful for presenting to an audience. You know, you can show one plot up there and say, we can do about this well. Right. But you're right. Once we're talking like, you know, CMB maps with millions of pixels, one shifts to a completely different way of analyzing them. Right.
I don't know how to explain this field, but if you believe the data, I had a conversation with a couple of people in this workshop, but you know, we were talking about the varying alpha beta. I don't know if you believe that the varying fine structure constant beta at around the same apex when
right.
Kicking in. But if you believe that, I mean, could that provide an alternative constraint? Like, would that change things back for the CMB, which would provide a bit more of a timeline?
So people have put constraints at some level from nucleosynthesis, for example, from recombination on how much alpha can vary. For that matter, there are limits from core collapse supernova. If you change alpha, you're changing the fusion chain in the reactions in a star, and you change the Chandrasekhar mass, basically. So without an underlying, you know, sort of global theory that tells you, you know, what is that varying alpha, what all its consequences are, it's a little tough to say, but I don't think that many people are worried about a varying fine structure constant yet, at least.
Great. Looks like there are again.